Welcome to the Diabetes What to Know podcast, where we talk to diabetes experts about how to live a long, healthy life with diabetes. We are talking with two different diabetes experts today about what people with diabetes should know about kidney disease. Our first guest is Amy Mossman, a physician assistant whose area of expertise is chronic kidney disease and hypertension. Amy, thanks so much for being here with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start out by talking about how folks watching at home can figure out whether they're having any issues with their kidneys. What information should they be looking at, and what should they be asking their doctor?
So kidney disease is very sneaky. You really won't notice any signs or symptoms at home. The best initial sign is if you are noticing that your blood pressures are going up. But lots of times you don't notice anything is happening for kidneys without going to your primary care, going to a medical expert to have a check done. The earliest signs that someone might see for symptoms can be extremely foamy urine. So many people will notice that if they have protein or stress on their kidneys, their urine doesn't have just a few bubbles. It looks like you poured a soda or a beer into the toilet. It is that thick, thick foam. And that's a sign of high protein. If that's present, that's a sign that something needs to be addressed and corrected.
So do any of the signs and symptoms or things that might alert us that kidney issues are happening, do any of those vary for men versus women?
Signs and symptoms usually do not vary for men or women. However, pregnancy can be a really remarkable stress test for the body. People have heard about a stress test for their heart, for heart attacks or strokes. Pregnancy is a lot of hormones, a massive change in the body, and it can be a future telltale sign of what health conditions may be in your future. And of course, this varies on your family history, your other health conditions, and a multitude of other things. But your pregnancies and having any complications, especially preeclampsia or gestational diabetes, if you're not diabetic already at that time, can really clue you into risk factors for you down the road.
So let's talk about our blood work. What are some of the signs in our blood work that our doctor would be looking at that would tell us that our kidneys are starting to have issues?
Since there are essentially no symptoms for early kidney disease, the blood work and urine are the most important two components for providers to look at to see how healthy the kidneys are. Kidneys are waste management. And so I like to think of them as almost like your waste control center and treatment center. They are going to be filtering toxins and waste products out of the body. They're going to be tinkering with the electrolytes, the minerals, the acid and base balance in our body. And then they're going to release what's not necessary, hold in what's good and nutrients or building blocks, things that our body needs to continue using. So if you're thinking about your kidneys as waste management, for the blood, we want to see, are they getting a backup in waste management? That test is most commonly used as creatinine, or the serum creatinine is how it's listed on your medical reports, or SCR. So that's one component, but we still want to see what our final product is, which is the urine. So if we see something in the urine, be it blood or protein as the most two prominent things, then that helps us see if there's stress going on or is there damage to the little working factories in the kidney that need to get help.
So our endocrinologist has talked about eGFR as something on blood work that people might want to look at as it relates to kidney health. What is eGFR and what should we be looking for?
eGFR is that other component to the creatinine level. The eGFR is essentially a way to recalculate and turn it into a percent kidney function that's a little more standardized amongst bodies. And it essentially converts you to a percent kidney function. So 100 would mean 100%, 60 would mean a 60%, and so on.
So Amy, let's talk about medications a little bit. I think people have gotten mixed messages over the years about certain blood pressure medications being harmful or helpful for the kidneys. Which ones are safe?
The best blood pressure medications are ones that are not just what I consider a blunt instrument on the blood pressure. When it comes to the kidneys, we want something that's going to do a directly targeted therapy to take stress off of them and reduce the risk of scar tissue and long-term damage. From that regard, ACE inhibitors or ARBs, angiotensin receptor blockers, are two different drugs that do a really good job of targeting a hormone pathway called the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, or the RAS system. That pathway is one that's very commonly triggered in high blood pressure, kidney disease, and diabetes to make our bodies hold on to salt or sodium, release potassium into our urine, and by holding on to the sodium and the salts, hold on to water and raise our blood pressures.
Similar question for you about diabetes medications. Which ones are helpful for the kidneys? Like, which ones should we be talking to our doctor about?
This time in medicine is extremely exciting for nephrology because we had the ACE inhibitors, we had the ARBs for high blood pressure, and they were shown to make a huge difference in outcomes and in that risk for ending up with renal failure or requiring dialysis. And now we have this wonderful new data on SGLT2 inhibitors, which again, it's a bit of a mouthful when you say it outright. It's the sodium glucose cotransporters in the kidney that you're blocking. So instead of soaking up more salt and more sugar in the kidney, we're letting it run downstream. So again, it's another pressure release valve that we're allowed to target in addition to the pressure release valve that we can target with ACE inhibitors and ARBs and make a massive difference in the long-term expectations and prognosis for diabetic kidney disease.
Oh, so exciting. Amy, does everyone with kidney disease end up on dialysis?
The most common cause for anxiety in my clinic is hearing the D word. Not every patient is going to end up on dialysis. We are talking about a multitude of factors that go into if you're going to need it or not. And a lot of our new medications, if we catch things early, can help us stave off the need for dialysis. If we don't catch kidney disease early, you do run a higher risk of needing dialysis. If you have a strong family history of kidney problems, you definitely have a higher risk, and we want to be very aggressive with your care and watching you to try to avoid that as much as humanly possible.
So I have a few questions for you specifically about women and kidney disease. Does menopause affect the kidneys?
Our hormones play a huge role in our life, and from the words of my obstetrician, every time they change for pregnancy, it's just like another puberty. Postpartum is like another puberty. And menopause is just another puberty, but in reverse. Menopause, as we're losing those hormones, does have a huge difference for our cardiovascular risks. Estrogen and progesterone have been shown to have a good heart protection. After those leave, our risk for heart disease do go up. And all of our studies for how to identify a heart attack and how to identify coronary vascular disease are actually very male-dominated research studies. Our symptoms can be different than a man's, and that plays a big role too. Going without hormones and then going back onto them for symptoms of menopause can also be a problem. So we want to try and get hormone replacement on as quickly as possible to prevent us from adding insult to injury with higher cardiovascular risk from losing our hormones and then throwing them back into the mix after our body's recalibrated. So we do have to pay more attention to those changes in our body, speak up and advocate for ourselves, and make sure that if we are doing anything for hormone replacements, there are many places that are doing alternative medicine with hormone supplements or testosterone supplements. If you're doing those, they can be done safely, but it's very important to know what you're getting, where it's coming from, and if it's having an effect on your metabolism, and if it's having an effect on your blood pressure. All of those things are going to end in one spot, and that's the kidney. And they're going to be the first thing that's either happy or not happy.
So it sounds like we really want to kind of make these decisions really in conjunction with our physician that we're seeing for our kidney issues, that we really want to keep them informed of whatever we're doing, whether it's HRT or herbal supplements, just kind of keeping them in the loop sounds like a good idea.
That's exactly right.
So what's changed in the way that healthcare professionals are thinking about and treating kidney disease now? We know there are new guidelines out. What's new? What should people know about them?
Kidney disease has gotten very prevalent in the United States. Up to 1 in 3 Americans are at risk for kidney disease. And a lot of that comes from the rise in the two major causes of kidney disease, which is high blood pressure and diabetes. From a prevention standpoint, the best thing you can do is have your kidney function checked by Unblood at least once a year. And especially with diabetes, your urine checked for protein at least once a year. And I would even recommend more frequently if you struggle with controlling your blood sugars and keeping them level.
Amy, thanks so much for being here and sharing such valuable information with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This episode has been created in partnership with Diabetes Sisters. Diabetes Sisters is an organization dedicated to supporting women with diabetes and those at risk in their life's journey by providing education and peer support. Our next guest is Amy Hess-Fischel, a dietitian and certified diabetes care and education specialist. Amy, thanks so much for being here with us.
It is such a pleasure to be with you today. Thank you.
So as a dietitian, what do you want everyone with diabetes to know about eating for good kidney health?
You know, I think that it's just important for people to understand, take all of that out of the equation. Healthy eating is what we want to do. So take a step back and understand those basics. And even I'm a big fan of just using visuals. So my plate from the Dietary Guidelines for Americans is a wonderful visual to just say, yes, we should be having half of our plate with fruits and vegetables. The other half, one quarter, should be some type of protein. Another quarter should be some type of whole grain, having some type of dairy. So we're not eliminating things. It's all about the serving sizes. But we also know that with diabetes, there's a higher risk for kidney disease. And we know that blood pressure and glucose control can impact that. So we do want to make sure that we're minimizing sodium and making sure that we're eating healthier fats to kind of round all of that out. So I want to say it's not rocket science, but I understand how overwhelming it is for all of you when it comes to eating healthy, because we are barraged with so many things that may not be healthy. But again, just going back to the basics, taking a deep breath and saying, am I eating fruits and vegetables? Can we just start there? And not adding extra salt to what we're consuming is a really good place to start.
So you're talking about kind of the plate method way of thinking about building a healthy meal, with the kind of half the plate non-starchy vegetables and fruits, and then grains and proteins. Is that the way you kind of encourage people to think about building a healthy meal?
Absolutely, because it's easy and it is evidence-based, meaning we have so much research showing the more fruits and vegetables we consume, the more whole grains, that fiber, healthy fat, that is what's going to help us lead a long, healthy life.
So is there anything women in particular should know about how our meal planning and eating habits can influence the health of our kidneys?
Nothing specific that is different than men. However, we do know that females are at higher risk for osteoporosis, osteopenia, meaning, again, our bones are not going to be as strong, leading to fractures. So in making sure that we are having some type of dairy products or some type of calcium-rich sources of foods. So again, that's really the only major difference. But, you know, for the most part, men and women are going to be very similar when it comes to the recommendations for eating.
So someone on our page asked, is there such a thing as eating too much protein? It seems like I gravitate to the protein-heavy foods to help cut down on carbs. Will this harm my kidneys? What would you say to her?
Everyone has that thought in their mind that when we think of kidney disease itself, protein may harm the kidneys. Now, there is no evidence that larger amounts of protein are going to cause kidney disease. But let's take a step back and talk about how much are we supposed to have when it comes to protein? There's a calculation, and it's about under half of a gram per pound of body weight, saying that, you know, again, if somebody's 180 pounds, they should have the equivalent of about 9 ounces of meat per day. That's about 65 grams. But remember, there's protein in milk, there's protein in nuts, there's in seeds and vegetables, and a little bit in whole grains. So we want to make sure that we're eating enough protein, which most people are. Some evidence does say even with progressing kidney disease, having plant-based proteins, so non-animal sources, again, may not have as much of an impact on kidneys as well. So again, rest assured that, you know, larger amounts of protein aren't going to harm your kidneys.
So for folks at home who are thinking plant-based protein, like what plants have protein? Give us some examples of really healthy plant-based protein sources that you love.
When we think of plant-based proteins, nuts, seeds are going to be the big ones. Beans and legumes. So all of those are wonderful plant-based proteins. But there are also meat substitutes that are made with plant-based proteins as well. All of those are perfectly acceptable. My caveat, though, is that, of course, when we think of kidney disease and we think of diabetes, we want to make sure that we're not overdoing the sodium content. So again, making sure that those products are not made with a lot of added sodium.
So for people who have elevated microalbumin levels, what adjustments should they be making to their eating habits?
Now, I want to set that stage that, of course, when we think of elevated microalbumin levels, again, that test that's done for people with diabetes, the urinary microalbumin test, if that's elevated, what that just tells us is that there are small amounts of protein that are coming out of the urine. And what that means is that it could progress to kidney disease. Now, it doesn't mean it's going to. But yeah, again, it's just that precursor that we want to keep an eye on and make sure that we do everything that we possibly can to maintain glucose levels as well as blood pressure levels. Now, when we get back to just healthy eating for somebody who has a little elevated microalbumin, the same as everyone else. We want to make sure that they're increasing their fruits, their vegetables, having whole grains, making sure that they are eating lower sodium. And the recommendation of lower sodium can vary depending on who you talk to. But again, the recommendations are anywhere between 2,000 and 2,300 milligrams per day. So again, all of those recommendations are basically the same when we think of just healthy eating in general, following my plate. Now, again, the research does show that just following those healthy guidelines could reduce the risk of progressing to kidney disease. Now, again, we have to highlight the fact that everything works together, and we want to make sure that blood pressure and blood glucose are also being maintained within healthy guidelines, because all of those things work together.
So if I'm wanting to eat a little less sodium, for example, like what's the low-hanging fruit? Like where are the places I can clean up and really see an impact quickly?
Oh, great question. We know that the easy low-hanging fruit is, of course, anything that's added to the food itself. So get rid of the salt shaker. Make sure that you are using more spices and herbs that are no salt at all. Now, there's lots of options that are out there in lots of different varieties that will make your food taste really great. So that's the first thing. Now, the second thing is looking at some of the canned fruit, vegetables, and making sure that you're using lower sodium versions of that. Soups as well, using lower sodiums of those. So again, those are going to be the biggies that if someone's going to just start kind of minimizing optimizing their sodium, going for reducing the salt in their canned products first, as well as the added salt that's in just about everything.
And frozen foods, are they a source of a lot of sodium?
They are not. So that is a wonderful option in place of canned vegetables. I love having people just switch from canned vegetables to frozen because, again, what they do with frozen is that they, you know, flash freeze them. And so then all the nutrients are there and there's nothing in it except those wonderful vitamins and minerals that we should be getting from vegetables. And you could get them all year round, unlike, depending on, like, I live in the Midwest, and so I don't have the options of fresh vegetables all year round that are going to taste as good as during the summer.
So for people with more advanced kidney issues, what should they be focusing on as it relates to what they eat?
Again, another great question. Now, I have to keep this very general for all of you. And I have to say this kind of to start off that if you have more advancing kidney issues, I do strongly encourage that you meet with a renal dietitian. So a dietitian that does specialize in kidney disease, because again, they're the end all be all that are going to know a lot more about your individualized needs. Because again, remember, it's all about individualization. But when we think of advancing kidney disease, we have to think about a couple other things. Now, certainly, just like what when we talk about kind of just healthier eating in general, we want to minimize sodium and still have fruits and vegetables. But we then have to start looking at blood levels and look at, does phosphorus need to be adjusted? Does potassium need to be adjusted? As people are progressing, does fluid intake need to be adjusted? So at each different stage, we may need to make some adjustments there if the blood levels are telling us to do so. Otherwise, we are still focusing on healthy eating overall. You still need to be including fruits and vegetables, protein. Again, we still want to include protein. Again, we may want to look at what you are truly eating and if something needs to be adjusted. But as it progresses, we just want to be looking at what is going to be right for you.
So are there any myths or common misunderstandings as it relates to kidney disease and food that you'd like to debunk for us?
A couple myths that I hear is you can't eat protein anymore. And again, that one thing that we have to understand is that healthy eating is still a requirement with kidney disease. You know, so I think that people just need to understand that the amount of protein that you may have may need to be altered, but in perhaps the types. So you know, again, you may need to be cutting back a little bit or even having some plant-based proteins. So again, meat substitutes, nuts, seeds, having, you know, more, you know, again, more beans and legumes, all of those things might be fine. But again, not eliminating things. So that's one myth that I hear a lot of. The second and third myths that I hear that kind of go hand in hand is that you can no longer have phosphorus foods. You can no longer have potassium foods. And the answer to those is no, that's not correct. We know that phosphorus and potassium may need to be altered, not eliminated, but altered depending on someone's blood levels.
So, Amy, how have the guidelines changed around how much protein and sodium people with kidney disease should be eating? Like, what's important for the people watching at home to know about the latest guidelines?
No, great question. There has been so many changes over the years when it comes to eating with phosphorus, potassium, sodium, fluid, protein. You know, those are the big five that we're always, focusing on when it comes to kidney disease. But, you know, again, one thing that we have to now understand is that phosphorus and protein adjustments may only be needed if there are blood level issues. The other one that just came out is lowering sodium. Now, again, Kidney International, as well as the National Kidney Foundation, anywhere between 2,000 and 2,300 milligrams of sodium per day. There is some newer evidence that says, yes, if you really reduce your sodium very, very low, yes, you're going to help blood pressure, you're going to help kidneys. But again, that may not necessarily be practical. for people. And so again, we have to understand that the guidelines as they stand, they're very individualized for the person that's sitting in front of us. So knowing that, you know, again, really is important, because again, gone are those days of, oh my gosh, we have to eliminate everything, you know, because again, the diabetes and kidney disease diet was not a fun thing to have a conversation about, because it's like, yep, we have to get rid of all of this stuff. And that's, it's now all about individualizing the person that's in front of us.
So all the more reason that if someone is confused about what they should be eating or just needs some additional help in terms of thinking about diabetes and kidney disease, they really want to be seeing a diabetes care and education specialist who focuses on this area.
Absolutely. We know that dietitians and diabetes care and education specialists are crucial for ongoing support for all of you. So we want to summarize some important key messages for all of you when it comes to coverage of both nutrition and diabetes education. So medical nutrition therapy is nutrition education from a registered dietitian. Those recommendations, newly diagnosed people with diabetes, it's 3 hours for the very first year and then 2 hours for all subsequent years. A doctor or a DO need to write the referral for medical nutrition therapy, and they can even do a second referral that'll allow for unlimited hours. So again, you can spend a lot of time with the dietitian to kind of help you. Now, the diabetes care and education specialist, the first year of anyone being diagnosed with diabetes, they get 10 hours of diabetes education. Is called diabetes self-management training. But every subsequent year, for 2 hours for every year after that. So again, you use those benefits that are through Medicare and many commercial insurances as well. So again, it's really important to know that you have a lot of people on your side to be able to help navigate all of these complexities that go with diabetes as well as with kidney disease.
Amy, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This has been a pleasure.
It has been my pleasure to be here with all of you. Thank you.
We'd like to thank the Boehringer Ingelheim Lilly Alliance for their sponsorship of this episode. This alliance is dedicated to helping people with diabetes live long, healthy lives. We will be back to you with a new episode in a few weeks. Until then, please stay safe and take good care. Good night.